We move to the fifth case for today, United States versus Murray.
May it please the court, my name is Laura Flath. I'm a third-year law student at the University of Chicago, appearing pursuant to Local Circuit Rule 34H. I represent defendant appellant Darnell Murray.
Let me ask you something off the bat. If we remand this case for resentencing in light of the restitution determination and Booker, are you running the risk of the court imposing a higher sentence?
We do run that risk, yes.
And is Mr. Murray aware of that fact?
Yes, he has been made aware of this fact. This paper, Defendant Appendix 5, is a sentencing summary chart that the district court used at Mr. Murray's initial sentencing to determine both the amount of restitution and the length of Mr. Murray's sentence.
But doesn't the district court, in the proceeding on remand, correctly identify that these are really two different questions? That for restitution, you need to look at the offense of conviction alone, whereas for the sentencing guidelines, you look at relevant conduct. So it's like you get the full set for one thing, which the court is still comfortable with, and then you have a subset for the restitution award, which the court goes back and, in a way, very favorable, I think, to Mr. Murray, comes up with a new restitution number. What's inconsistent about that?
It is true that there are two different numbers at issue here. The restitution amount is based on the actual loss caused, whilst the sentence is determined upon the intended loss. However, both of these numbers come from the sentencing summary chart that the district court explicitly found to be unreliable at that initial remand.
I don't see where the district court finds that unreliable. I thought really what she says is more, I can't tell from this chart which is really offense conduct and which isn't, so I'm going to be very conservative and take this $195,000 and some dollar amount, because that I know is right. She said, I know I'm not limited to that amount, but I know that that's right. So isn't that really what she's saying, as opposed to something more sweeping, like the whole chart ought to be thrown out the window?
Well, on page 32 of the transcript from the district court's remand, she stated that after having examined the government exhibit sentencing chart and its repeated recalculation and the broad brush approach used in constructing that chart, I don't find that the government has sustained its burden.
Now, which burden are we talking about here?
That burden is the same for both. Both standards, it's a preponderance of the evidence.
But I would have thought she's saying right there, it's burden to show how much is attributable to offense conduct. I would plug back in the final line in this court's prior opinion in this case, which asks the court to find that particular fact.
Both these numbers, though, the amount of actual loss and the amount of intended loss, are calculated in the same way within this chart.
Well, yeah.
And so by failing to prove that burden by the preponderance of the evidence standard with respect to restitution, the amount of intended loss was also necessarily impacted. And the court refused to use any of those numbers used in the sentencing chart and only relied upon the exhibits that were used at trial.
Hmm.
Under those exhibits used at trial, the amount of intended loss can only be shown to be $240,000.
Well, you know, you argued that the issue related to the calculation of the loss amount couldn't be waived because it wasn't available before the remand. Right?
Yes.
But is the reason that it was unavailable in the first appeal because the amounts were not disputed in the district court prior to the original sentence? In other words, was there a challenge? Was there a challenge to the calculations in the sentencing summary chart in the district court at the initial sentencing?
The district trial counsel for the defense did object to the initial pre-sentencing report. However, the district court judge found that it was persuasive at the time. It was at the initial remand that she then found that this chart was utterly unreliable and that the government had not sustained its burden. Thus, we argue that this argument became available once the district court judge had thrown out this chart. It was then that Mr. Murray's sentence should have been reconsidered because the amount of intended loss was necessarily linked to that chart.
Now, also, of course, although the Supreme Court's decision in Booker wasn't available prior to our resolution of the earlier appeal, couldn't essentially the same argument have been raised based on the Seventh Circuit's decision in Booker?
While it possibly could have been raised, the timing of the decision was very close to when this court was taking it under advisement. And, you know, the United States versus Palladino had not been issued at this time. We argue that it is not waiver. Waiver, as this court has held in this original appeal, is the intentional relinquishment of a known right, and the right to be sentenced under a discretionary sentencing regime rather than a mandatory sentencing regime was not readily known at the time.
Well, except that it does occur to me, our earlier decision was argued April 6, 2004, and our Booker decision came out in early July of that year. And I assure you, there was a flood of supplemental authority filings and petitions for rehearing and all manner of other things the minute our decision in Booker came down, saying, at least as far as we could tell, Blakely also applied to the federal sentencing guidelines. And it does seem to me, if Mr. Murray had raised that and brought it before this court before our opinion was issued, it's quite possible the remand might have been a broader remand. It wouldn't have been just a remand for restitution, which then makes me think, well, the failure to do that perhaps is something that should at the most limit Mr. Murray to a Palladino remand, not just a full resentencing, which, by the way, may be a favor for him, as you know, but that's another matter that we won't think about. But, you know, our Booker case was quite clear quite clearly on point.
Well, while the counsel for Mr. Murray could have raised that, perhaps have filed a supplemental brief, we would argue that this is not necessarily waiver. So even if this court should not review it for abuse of discretion, it still would be reviewed under
it's
a plain error.
At least plain error, you're saying. Sure.
In which case, we argue that this definitely does satisfy the plain error test. This is clearly in effect on Mr. Murray's substantial rights. As this court has held in Palladino, these Booker considerations are important. We argue, however, that this should not just be limited to a purely Palladino remand because of the district court's fact findings. Mr. Murray is entitled to a full remand on those facts that the district court found.
And you've weighed that decision very carefully.
We have discussed it with Mr. Murray. I mean, it is a risk, but the preponderance of the evidence, you know, the district court judge threw out that evidence, and under the evidence that she found to be persuasive and to meet the requisite burden of proof, you know, it was only $240,000, which would lower the guideline range that Mr. Murray should have been sentenced on. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Barst?
May it please the court, my name is Jim Bars and I represent the United States. Both of the issues that are being raised by the defendant appellant, both the calculation of loss under the guidelines and the Booker claim, were beyond the scope of the remand, and there is no exceptional circumstance in this case that justifies an expansion of the remand.
Well, in this case, we have both an intervening Supreme Court case and a decision by the district court that cast doubt upon the validity of the original sentence. I'm having trouble understanding why those aren't the type of exceptional circumstances envisioned by the law of the case doctrine. And while you're answering that, maybe you can point me to any other case in which even a Palladino remand has been denied in circumstances similar to this one. I mean, your office has certainly taken a hard line in this case.
Well, as to the Booker issue, it's not an exceptional circumstance because two reasons. One is the intervening change in the law did not affect the issue that was remanded. The only issue that was remanded was the restitution calculation. And we relied upon United States versus George, where this court held that Booker does not apply to restitution. It's a civil remedy that does not affect the punishment, if you will. It's sort of an add-on. We'll resolve the civil claim at the time of sentencing.
But the court's determination of the restitution issue on remand called into question the validity of its loss calculation in the original sentence. So surely that, well, at least arguably, opens up that aspect of the sentence.
It's the government's position that the district court's modification of the restitution award on remand did not impact its loss calculation, and the district court, I think, explicitly said so. And it's on page 35 of the transcript, which is tab 2 of the appellant's brief. The district court said that the government did show a loss amount was far greater than the restitution amount. The district court, in doing this ruling, it needs to be that one statement that they rely upon needs to be taken in context of the entire proceedings before the district court.
Mr. Barnes, my problem with that is the ambiguity in the district court's comments, because it's two pages before that we have the excerpt that we were looking at before, where the court just says broad things like, after having examined government exhibit sentencing chart and its repeated recalculation and the broad brush approach used in constructing that chart, I don't find that the government has sustained its burden on an amount. And there's just this general language. And then we come up to page 35, the part you were just talking about. And we don't know whether it's based on this chart that she now thinks maybe is reliable, that she says the over-inclusion was not in loss and intended loss. There's a real ambiguity here in her comments.
I think those comments can best be understood by putting them in context of the entire proceeding. At the original sentencing hearing, defense counsel did object to the loss calculation. The district court overruled those, and as I cited in our brief, I think on page 7, she found that the circumstantial links were very persuasive. And those circumstantial links, if we walk back in time on this, we have an individual who's basically taking other people's identities, adding themselves to their Sam's Club cards and their credit cards, and committing fraud at Home Depot and Sam's Club. He's linked to those because, you know, even though he got away with a lot of fraud, he didn't do this in a real sophisticated manner. He's putting his name on these accounts. He's calling from his residence or a residence linked to him. He's using an alias, but then he'll use that same one over and over. He'll use the same account. We had fingerprint evidence. We had his picture as the complimentary spouse of another man. All sorts of things that are comical, and you know, but also linked him to it. So at trial, we said, well, we've got to prove $1,000 here. We put in $240,000, which included actual losses and attempted losses. Transactions like when we caught his cousin and got him to cooperate, caught him at the store. They didn't get through with that, and he did it. Then when it comes to sentencing, we had Kelly Meter, who works for GE Capital, which runs the credit card programs for both the Home Depot and the Sam's Club. She takes all of the fraud that he was involved in, not just the 240 at trial, but she adds also additional transactions on that same those same 25 accounts, plus new accounts that went back to December of 2001 to total up the $600,000
prior to
figure.
The indictment. Yeah,
and the
right.
Circumstantial links that are reflected on that summary chart are his name, his phone number, common aliases, same accounts, same date, time frame. Those circumstantial links, the district court found, were very persuasive in overruling the objections at the sentencing hearing. Now we get to the remand. And on remand, I interpreted it, I think, as Your Honor was suggesting, that it was limited to determining, okay, what on the sentencing summary chart is offense conduct,
right?
What is relevant conduct? And it's pretty clear what happened there, and I think that's the frustration that the district court expressed, is no one had a calculator. So we had a number of adjustments to make.
Well, this was not something you want the math teachers of the United States to look at, this exchange among all of you trying to add up these numbers.
So the district court directs me to start with the trial evidence. So we start with the trial evidence, the $240,000. We say we must take out the attempted transactions, for one. And secondly, I raised up this point. I said, well, March 28th and 29th are outside of the charged period. She said, okay, well, out of an abundance of caution, take those out. then we've got to credit him with his $3,000 that we recovered from him at the time of his arrest. So we've got a $195,000 figure. That's accepted. The court says that was in a trial. That's beyond a reasonable doubt. That I accept. Now you want me to consider this other stuff on the chart, and we had to do the same math calculations. We take out March 28th, 29th. We take out the $88,000 we waived. We take out the $3,000 we gave him, and I think I came up with a 592 number once. I did it again. I came up with 594, and that's where she makes some comments about, you know, not being prepared for this kind of math. We're all doing this on the back of pieces of paper, counsel as well. And I think that in that context, she says, and I think what you quoted is exactly right. She says, the government has not sustained its burden as to an amount. An amount. She's saying, you haven't convinced me with all these math going back and forth, what I'm asking you to make these adjustments, that we've got an amount that I can find by preponderance of the evidence at this point in time.
And you are arguing that we have to put the words in brackets for restitution, you know, or something like that, or for actual offense conduct. She doesn't actually say that, though.
Yes,
that's the problem.
But she never says, those circumstantial links that I found were very persuasive when I originally sentenced this individual are no longer persuading me. The common phone numbers, the common names, the common aliases, the common dates. She never talks about those. And that's why I think if you put it in that context, you understand she's not saying that it's no longer reliable. And she bookends it because now you've got, at the original sentencing, she says it's very persuasive. And at the end of this, when they raise this argument, she says, no, no, no. They're different standards. And I do find, she reaffirms it. She says that I do find the government did show the loss amount was far greater than the narrower restitution calculation. And it is a narrower standard because you're talking about, for loss guidelines, reasonable estimates. For restitution, an actual precise amount to an identified victim. For loss calculations, you include intended loss, attempted transactions. And for loss calculations, as most relevant in this case, you include relevant conduct. You include all the relevant conduct. So even if any of those transactions that were not proven at trial can somehow be argued to be relevant conduct, they still come in for loss guideline calculations. And the district court, I think on multiple occasions, and most succinctly on that page 35, indicated that the district court was comfortable with its original guideline calculations.
And what about a Palladino remand?
Well, it's the government's position, two things. In this case, it's not warranted because, as to the Booker claim, two reasons. One, the intervening change in the law did not relate to the issue that was on remand, so it would be beyond the scope of remand. And secondly...
But that's not the issue with most of these Palladino things. The issue, even at the Supreme Court level, has been whether the case is still alive. There were petitions for cert pending, you know, that the court grant vacated and remanded for reconsideration in light of Booker that were raising all manner of questions.
Well, and I guess that's our point, is it's not an exceptional circumstance because they had opportunities to raise Booker.
No, but all I'm saying is the Supreme Court, at least, has been sending things back for Booker reconsideration quite liberally, and why shouldn't this court follow the same, at least insofar as a Palladino plain error remand is concerned?
And following up with Judge Rovner's question, I'm not aware of any case other than Lange. Lange was the only case I found that touched on this, and the government, we cited that, and I haven't found one since then, before then, that talked about where you've got a limited remand. But I would point out two things in that regard. It's a remand for restitution, the civil remedy. And then secondly, there were multiple opportunities for them to raise this before. And Your Honor's identified some. And I would just point out one more interesting point of this. I cited in my brief when I noted that other people had been availing themselves of opportunities to file motions for leave to address Booker claims, or Blakely claims even, before Booker came. I cited Askew as one such example. Well, Askew was not just any case. Askew was argued April 6, 2004, the same day that Murray was argued, and it was argued by the same legal clinic that argued Murray's appeal. And they filed, in that case, a motion for leave to file after Blakely to address the issues raised by Blakely in that case, did not do it in Murray. Now, I expected one to be filed in this case, and when it wasn't filed, I thought that it was a calculated decision, given that if anyone made a mistake in this case, it was me by not moving for an upward departure based upon his 31 criminal history points in the original sentencing. I was a new prosecutor here, and I thought that was an opportunity I'd missed. I thought it was a strategic decision that they were going to challenge because the two issues they sort of raised were vacate the conviction because of trial errors and also restitution, but they didn't go after the sentence. And I thought that that was a calculated decision at that point in time. And I certainly, if it does get remanded, would avail myself of the opportunity to seek the upward departure that probably was warranted in this case. But in any case, it's the government's position that for all these reasons, there was no exceptional circumstance. The case should be affirmed. It was a limited remand, and we'd ask this court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Forrest.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes. I'll give you another minute, since I gave the government another minute.
The government emphasizes that the district court judge was still persuaded by those circumstantial links to the evidence. That's not true. It is in the record on page 27 that the government stated, all of these things discussing the restitution at the time were found by this court at a preponderance of the evidence at the initial sentencing hearing. And the court interrupted the government to say, now I have to correct you there. That wasn't any dispute about it. That doesn't mean I affirmatively found that it was the corrected amount. So
how can she say that, though? I mean, she had to have found a range to come up with the correct sentencing guideline. I mean, she may say that, but she has to have found something.
That may have been true at the time that she was persuaded by this, but looking at it as this court ordered her to do, both the act, while they are two different numbers, the amount of loss caused is included within the amount of intended loss. And therefore, if that number was not, the government failed to meet its burden, the government had ample opportunities to present more evidence at the hearing to back up that chart, which it failed to do, then that both those numbers were clearly affected when the district court judge declined, after stating that she found it unreliable, she declined to use it.
You know, Ms. Plath, you now know something that you did not know when you walked into this courtroom, and that is that should this case be remanded, the government is going to request an upward departure. So you might want to take 5 days and let us know if your position remains as it did when you walked into this courtroom.
All right.
Yeah. If you'll just provide the court with that and counsel with affirmation or whatever that you're still willing to proceed.
We will. Thank you for your time.
Thanks to Ms. Flath, Professor Mitka and the University of Chicago Legal Clinic, thank you very much for taking this case. Thanks to counsel for the government as well. Case will be taken under advice.